This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Several prominent companies have recently found themselves in situations that are public relations nightmares. United Airlines, Adidas, and Facebook are just the latest examples. So what's the best course of action? Madman's Don Draper told his clients, if you don't like what's being said, change the conversation. But how do you do that in a way that repairs the damage? We will talk about that later in the program. First, one of the world's most talented and funniest men, Martin Short. He got his start in his native Canada, but began taking the U.S. by storm during his time on Saturday Night Live, creating one memorable character after another. Then he had success in film and on Broadway, snagging a Tony Award. Martin Short will be in Charlotte on Saturday night at Ovens Auditorium with Steve Martin, but somehow we convinced him he should join us first. Martin Short, welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
You're in Cary, North Carolina this morning.
I am, and it's gorgeous. I'm looking out at the most beautiful scene.
That's the wrong thing to say to people in Charlotte.
Why, is there a feud?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Have you all, when you think back on your life, have you always been funny? When did you know, my gosh, I'm funny? I have a sense of humor. People laugh at me.
You know, I grew up in a very funny house, and I was the youngest of five children. And I think that if you grow up where your siblings are funny, and your mother's funny, and your father's funny, it's trickle-down. It's like Reagan's trickle-down economics, except this is comedy. And so suddenly, you combine that instinct in the house with the fact that being the youngest, you're adored, you never walk until you're about six because no one puts you down, and everything you do is, oh, isn't it fabulous, and get up and perform, little Marty. And so you have the confidence from that, and you have the instinct from your family.
Mm-hmm. But you're a quadruple threat. You're not just funny. You're a writer. You're an actor. You're a singer. There's probably something else in there that you do, too, that I don't know. How did all of that develop? Because that's quite an arsenal that you have at your disposal.
Well, I think that certainly when I was a kid, I wanted to be, Sinatra and Tony Bennett and all those guys. I mean, I used to go into my attic bedroom. I had this great attic bedroom, and I used to do imaginary television shows up there. I had an applause record. I did. I had a lot of tape recorders, and I had looped the end of Sinatra at the Sands, and I had looped it so that the applause would continue and continue and continue. And, I used to have my own imaginary television show every other week on NBC.
Why NBC?
I don't know why NBC, but it was every other week, so it left time for my imaginary film career.
Okay.
I was too big to be gotten every week, then I wanted to be a singer, comedy was kind of natural in the family, as I said. And I think that growing up in Canada, where there's no star system, starting off my career in Canada, where there's no star system for the first, 7 years of my career, it was just in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of naturally do this as a, you do everything because that's what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to, you can't just do one thing. You don't say, you don't have a manager. You just say when you're hired, do I bring a suit? So you have to either sing, or you have to dance, or you have to act, or do comedy. It's kind of like the old MGM days where everyone, Frank Sinatra is dancing up the storm with Gene Kelly because that's the way you survive.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people from Canada, and there are a lot of comedians from Canada, particularly in your generation and the generation that followed, that seem to have migrated to the United States and really done well for themselves. But is there something about Canada that makes people funny, because it's Gilda Radner, it's you, it's Eugene Levy, many other people that I can't even think about on the top of my head. But Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live, the producer.
Catherine O'Hara, Seth Rogen.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is it about Canada?
I used to think, because I've been asked this before, and I used to think, it's a silly question. There's nothing about borders that changes any, where you live. But then as they kept coming down, Mike Myers, Phil, mm-hmm. and you just kind of go, wow, I guess there might be something, because there's only 34 million people up there. And I think what it is that we're almost like the middle sibling of three, you know, brothers, and one's the sexy young brother, and that's the United States, and one is the elegant, sophisticated older brother, and then we're kind of in the middle, and we're kind of making fun of both of you, and slight inferiority complex, because, you know, no one's looking at us because they're a middle child. And that sometimes is a great, it creates great satire. And I think a lot of satirists, as opposed to stand-ups, have come from Canada in the last 20 years.
And could it also be that in the U.S., because things are so competitive here and there's so many people vying for the limited number of slots that are available and the limited number of people who make it to the top, is it that you are so versatile because it's so open in Canada? You can pretty much pick what you want to do, and you get good at a bunch of stuff. I mean, is that part of it?
Well, I think it is. I always used to think that, you know, my first 7 years were just only in working in Toronto. And I used to think it was like kind of like being at university, where you got to do everything.
Hmm.
And again, because there was no star system that just labeled you and said, oh, no, you're a movie star, or you do comedy, or you sing, it allowed you to get better at everything by just doing it. Because the more, as you know, from doing this for 19 years, your show, the you're better today than you were 19 years ago. You just get better at what you get to keep doing.
Except I went to the wrong studio today.
Well, that's so true. I'm not talking about, you know, mental issues that happen with age.
That's with age.
I'm just saying that, assuming you're in the right studio, wow, are you on fire today as opposed to before?
Yeah. Talk to me about that, because you do a lot. You've been described as somebody who doesn't need – a lot of comedians need to be funny. They need to assert that – they need to tickle your funny bone to validate themselves. And you've been described as somebody who isn't driven to be funny. You're actually well-adjusted, but you can turn it on when you need to. Like when you go on these late-night talk shows and you sit in a chair, you can hold the floor. How do you do that? Do you think about it before you go on?
Well, wouldn't it be awful if someone, when you see someone, you know, kind of on fire on Letterman,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't it be awful if that's what they were like every second of the day?
Yeah.
Despise them. you know what it is? It's a business. It's what you do. If you go on Jimmy Fallon's show, you're not doing Charlie Rose and being interviewed. You're doing a variety show. You've got 9 minutes to entertain. And so you're kind of doing your job.
So do you prep for that? Do you prepare material
Absolutely.
For that?
Absolutely. Oh, okay. I'm crazy with that. I send in literally 20 pages, 15 pages of notes.
Wow.
To the segment producer, and we go over everything. And then the secret is to then do the interview and look like you're improvising.
Of course. Of course, the only thing we got from
and
you
a
is
a lot of it, by the way, a lot of it is made up, because what that preparation does is it gives you the confidence to go out with, you know, gunning for bear, and kind of then you can wander off what you planned because you feel confident to do that.
I'm curious then why the only thing we got from you and your people today was you have to be let go by sometime Friday afternoon. That's the only thing that that's the only note we got here.
I know. Well, I it's a hard deal with me.
You're also you're not just a stand-up. As a matter of fact, I don't think you consider yourself a stand-up. I think you consider yourself a character actor. Or how do
I would
you?
Say I'm an entertainer.
Okay. But one of the things that you're really famous for are these incredibly quirky, wonderful, funny characters that you have been able to create over the years. I sat and watched yesterday a series of YouTube clips. Isn't YouTube wonderful?
Best in the world.
And
how about you can now project it onto your TV? That's what
yes.
That's the most fun.
But I sat there and watched you as Jiminy Glick. And I'm by myself in my office, and I am literally doubled over. I cannot breathe. And some of these clips are really old with Jerry Seinfeld. Some of them are newer. But what a wonderful character Jiminy Glick is. Where did he come from?
I was doing a talk show for King World in 1999-2000, and I wanted to create a... I wanted to be able to go out and do things and people wouldn't recognize me, but I'd already done too many characters at that point. And people would come up, and I'd think I had a putty nose and a silly wig, and they'd say, "Mr. Short, can I have your autograph?" And I thought, gee, that's not good. And then I remember I'd made a movie called Pure Luck with Danny Glover. At one point, I'm stung with a bee, by a bee, and I swell up. And no, everyone always said at that point, "I can't see you in there. Who are you?" And I thought, oh, that's the look I should do. And then I made him an entertainment reporter just so I could have more guests on the show.
For people who don't know, and I can't imagine there's anybody who doesn't know who Jiminy Glick is, he is a talk show host. He is corpulent.
Yes, and he was filled with, he was, I always described him as a moron with power. Someone who had gotten to a position, who had assistants who were terrified if they screwed up in the lunch order, but he had no knowledge. Like he once said to Mel Brooks, "What's your big beef with the Nazis?" You know. Or he said to Steven Spielberg, "When are you going to do the big one, the one that connects with the people?" You know.
So he knows nothing.
Knows nothing.
And so all the insults that he throws out are not, they're just out of ignorance. They're not really out of malice.
So it's never the person that feels badly. It's always Jiminy.
But you always talk to famous people as Jiminy Glick. I mean, really famous people, and some mostly comedians, as a matter of fact.
Right.
What kind of preparation do they have going into this? Do they have any idea? What?
Zero.
No idea.
Zero.
So they're having to riff as you throw things at them. How much preparation do you put into the interview?
Not much. You know, it's so weird. I mean, I've done so many kinds of characters through the years, and some are very, you know, prepared and studied. I do this character, Nathan Thurm, who was a defensive lawyer, and it was all rhythms, you know. I know that. You don't think I know that? I'm a lawyer. I would know that. Or Ed Grimley, who would be, I'd write it out, and then I'd improvise it within the sketch. But Glick is all improvised, so that I would even see playbacks of it, and I'd think, you know, at one point, Jiminy would say, "I take great umbrage." And I think, I don't even know what that means. I've never said that in my life. So it is a kind of, at times, a form of channeling.
Yeah, he's spontaneous.
But I do, you know, what we do is we do shoot it like movies. So I remember I was doing interviewing Alec Baldwin. And we did, you know, you'll do a pass for 10 minutes. Then you maybe take a little break. You'll fix up your makeup and you do another 10 minutes. And then you cut that down to 5 minutes, 6 minutes. And in the break, I said, "Alec, do you have anything I should ask you?" He said, "Ask me about women." I said, "Okay." So then I just kept asking him about women. He kept talking about, you know, him having sex with Barbara Boxer and stuff like this. He was making stuff up. And it was brilliant. So he was, in that case, he was a participant in the final creation.
And Jiminy Glick, I'm told, makes an appearance in this show you're doing on Saturday night with Steve Martin.
Yes, he does.
Well, that'll be fun. That'll be worth the price of admission alone.
Steve, I love your smile. It's like an email from Grandma, all caps.
Martin Short is our guest, actor, comedian, and incredibly, I was going to say famous. Of course you're famous. That's why you're here.
I wouldn't be on your show.
That's right. Exactly. Why are you here?
Exactly.
Did you lose your way?
Exactly.
The show he's doing.
At least I'm in the right studio.
That's right. The show he's doing here on Saturday night is called An Evening You Will Forget. We'll talk about that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gardner-Webb University, committed to preparing students for professional and personal success around the corner and around the world. Now accepting summer and fall applications at gardner-webb.edu. And Ashe County, celebrating the arrival of spring with hiking, kayaking, and fishing, located in the northwest corner of North Carolina, bordering Tennessee and Virginia. Details on Ashe County at thecoolestcorner.com. Tomorrow on the local news roundup, the NCAA is bringing the championship games back to North Carolina, but not new ones for Charlotte. The ACC does bring their football championship to the Queen City, along with other events throughout the state. Charlotte-based Bank of America announces their higher-than-expected first-quarter earnings, while Wells Fargo is the subject of another lawsuit connected to the improper sales practices scandal. Our roundtable of reporters set to talk about those stories and more tomorrow on this program. It's the local news roundup at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, France readies for a high-stakes election that could lead to the end of the European Union itself. We'll look at the populist wave and France. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest in this segment, Martin Short, who will be in town on Saturday night at Ovens Auditorium at 8. We have details on this on our website at WFAE.org. He's here with Steve Martin. In an evening you will forget for the rest of your lives.
Why the alternative title is called See Them Before They're Dead.
Why did you build yourselves up so high? I mean, really, the ego is astounding here.
I know. It really is true.
What's the show like?
It is, you know, I'd say this anyway, but it is really a hilarious show. And I think what's interesting about it is that I've never seen a show that goes for 2 hours that is just wall-to-wall laughs, from the opening montage of the best of both our works to Steve coming out to then me coming out to the stand-up to the... Because there's so many elements of it. Catherine O'Hara described it as a children's show for adults. But, you know, we have the Steep Canyon Rangers. We sit and chat for a bit. We do stand-up. We do sketches. I do 30 minutes by myself. He does 30 minutes by himself. There's so many elements to it. That it's like an... At one point, we go into the audience and pull up three volunteers and turn them into the Three Amigos.
You have one hat or three?
Three.
Okay.
So there's a lot of improvising. There's a lot of sketch. There's a lot of stand-up. There's unbelievable bluegrass music. Really spectacular. And there's whatever I do.
Yeah, it's so good that Steve Martin has that banjo to fall back on.
You know? Yeah, because he doesn't have enough talent.
That's exactly right. So I understand that. First of all, did you the two of you meet in the movie The Three Amigos? Is that how you met each other, or had you worked together
we
before?
We met. I remember going to his house on Bedford Drive, his old house in Beverly Hills. You know, I have this kind of Rain Man memory where I can remember dates, and I used to think everyone had it. It's kind of like what Mary Lou Henner has, you know.
Oh, my gosh, because she remembers everything.
Well, it's
everything.
Not that good, because I was telling someone this the other day, and then I forgot the name Henner. So I don't know quite what she... Mary Lou, what's her name? So anyway, and then I picked up a script from his house, and, you know, I walked in, and it was like there was Steve Martin, and there was this insane house, you know, with Picasso's, you know, his major art collection. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I said to him was, I said... Steve, you know, how did you get this rich? Because I've seen your work. And that kind of broke the ice, you know.
Although you did have a crisis of confidence at one point. I read this yesterday. You always think of people like you who are on national television and do film and have this live performance career as being people who are supremely confident, and they have a right to be because they've proven themselves time and time again. But there was this moment in time when you had this crisis of confidence. You were on the way over to have dinner with somebody. I've forgotten who, and you were walking with your wife.
I'll tell you when it was. It was February 1977. You see, I'm doing it like Rain Man. And my wife and I, we weren't married then, were walking over to have dinner with Paul Schaefer and Bill Murray.
Okay.
And it was in Hollywood, and I had, you know, I hadn't wanted to do improv or Second City or anything of that. I didn't feel, I think I was afraid of it. So I thought, oh, I'll do plays. I'll do musicals. That's what I'll do in Toronto. And now I was, by that instinct, I was being left behind a little bit by my friends. And they had already started SCTV and things like that. Anyway, Bill was now freshly on Saturday Night Live, and Paul, of course, was on Saturday Night Live. And I'm walking over there, and I just reached this corner, Flores and Hollywood Boulevard. And I said to my wife, I can't, I got to sit down. She said, why? I said, I don't know. I can't go any further. Oh, okay. So we sat in a park bench. And she said, but after 5 minutes, how long are we going to sit here? And I said, I don't know. But I cannot go and pretend to be happy for Bill and pretend to be happy and pretend I don't know what I'm doing in my life. You know, I was 26 years old, and I had been now out of university for 4 years, and I just knew that I had to go break through some other dimension. I had to go through some creepy corridor to get to a beautiful new room, and I was in that creepy corridor, and I didn't know how to get to that room. And it was so. And that night we went and saw an improv group called War Babies, and I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. So I phoned up Andrew Alexander, who ran Second City in Toronto, said, you know, because he had invited me earlier to join the cast. I said, now I'd like to join the cast. And I did, and my life changed.
You know, that looks like a lot of fun, but it also seems to be would put a lot of pressure on a performer. You really have to be able to not only think on your feet, but you've got to contribute to what's going on in an improv situation in such a way that the other people don't get shut out. They need to be able to keep up. Everybody needs to be able to keep up and add their own thing so that it all works together as a unit. It's like walking on glass, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not as scary as you think it is before you do it.
Hmm.
Because what you find out, for example, that what gets the biggest laugh if you're improvising is the reaction to something, not necessarily what you say, but how you respond to what someone said. Or there are rules like you can't deny. If someone says, hey, I saw you at a party last week, if your response is, oh, I wasn't at a party, then that's the end of scene.
Right.
So you have to say, hey, I saw you at a party last week. Yes, I know, it was a great party. And you just have to keep moving it along. You have no idea where it's going to end and how it's going to end.
So was your experience with Second City before Godspell? Or after
Godspell? Oh, no, Godspell was the first thing. I was still in university.
Oh, my goodness.
And I decided to take, you know, I had never left school. So I decided to take a year off school. And I talked to all my professors, and what do you think? Is it a good idea? And they said, of course. I had my BA, and I was going to do a master's in social work. So I took a year off. My plan was to start in September, like a school year, go to the following June. If it wasn't working out, I'd go back to school. And when I was still in university, they were auditioning for this show, Godspell, in Toronto, and everyone wanted it. And 1,000 people auditioned, and it was like American Idol. It got down to 10 people. Hmm. And the 10 people were people that didn't know each other, but all would become pretty famous. Gilda Radner had never done anything. Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Victor Garber, Paul Schaefer. Martin Short, all in one company.
Yeah, Paul Schaefer was the music. I did hear this.
He was just playing piano for a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And Stephen Schwartz,
who wrote the
show. Boss and wrote it, said, well, I don't care about her, but who's that guy pounding that piano? Mm. So he went up to Paul and said, midway through that final callback day, he said, you know, I hate my rehearsal pianist who's playing. He can't play rock and roll. If I fire him right now and you take over, will you take over if I make you musical director of the show? And he did. It's pretty.
Wow.
It was all like out of the movies, kind of stuff.
Yeah, because that whole group of people went on to, as you say, become very successful in their own
right.
Yeah,
and I was
later
21.
On. Wow, wow. You were one of those people that were in the year of Saturday Night Live that Lorne Michaels was not part of. He'd walked away. I think he did it for 4 or 5 years and
right.
thought, well, that's it.
He left in 1980. Well, you know, in those days, you didn't know that the show was going to go up for
right.
2 years. You thought maybe 5 years is plenty.
And in my head, when I think of you on Saturday Night Live, I think you were there for 10 years, but you were only there for 1 year.
I was there 1 year.
Boy, you made an impact.
Well, you know, as we were, Billy Crystal and I both had one-year contracts, and I think what that resulted in is that we treated it like it was 22 specials. Mm-hmm. So in other words, sometimes, you know, whoever is the cast member, you'll turn on SNL and they're in, you know, one scene or something. We never felt we could do that. We felt too much pressure on us because we knew we weren't going to be there.
Wow.
The following year.
But the impact that you had, I mean, I know that you had done Ed Grimley
on SCTV.
SCTV,
right.
But a lot of Americans hadn't seen SCTV. So that character sticks out, several others stick out, and it was like to make that kind of impression in 22 episodes of a late-night television show that If you were like me, you didn't see every single one of them.
Nor did I, and I was doing it.
To make that kind of an impression just seems to be remarkable in one season. That just it's amazing to me. Do you, when you look back on that, do you wish that you'd stayed another year at least, or not? Or you, was one enough?
You know, I had already done 3 years of SCTV, which was all-consuming. And SNL was certainly all-consuming. I had a new little baby. Mm-hmm. I thought 4 years was plenty. I mean, in retrospect, though, yeah, sure, I wish I had a...
Because, as you say, it's all-consuming. And the people just see you in the 90 minutes that you're on the show, and you're not in every skit, so obviously it's an easy job.
But there are, remember, there's so many sketches that,
yes,
that
don't
almost
make it.
Made it and were cut.
Right.
So it really is, my analogy was always that it was like having final exams at university every week.
I can relate. You won a Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical for the revival of Neil Simon's Little Me. You got a Tony nomination for The Goodbye Girl with Bernadette Peters. You turned down the co-starring role with Nathan Lane in The Producers. But let's talk about a musical theater role that people, a lot of people, must have seen you in, because it was recent and it was on television, but it was a one-shot deal. It's one night only. Hairspray. You played Wilbur Turnblad in NBC's live production of Hairspray.
Right.
I know you're a live performer, but live TV is always made out to be something really dangerous and very scary. Is it? I mean, if you're prepared.
When I was in rehearsal of it, I had so many actors, I won't tell their names, but people who have won Tonys, who have done, you know, 12 Broadway shows, who said, I wouldn't do that if my, you know, never would I do something like that. Because it is this daunting thing that if you go blank, there's no cue cards, there's no one prompting you. It's, you're going blank in the middle of a dance number in front of, you know, how many millions of people.
Right.
So it, but, you know, my approach to everything is if I over-prepare, if I really do everything I could have done, then I accept the outcome. It's the only time I get upset is if in any way I didn't do my job, or I didn't commit as much as I should have, I was too spread thin, and I see the results that are disappointing, then I beat myself up. So even if I'd gone blank on the screen, I would have thought, look, I'm, you know, pinch me, you know, prick me and I bleed. I'm a human being. But it didn't happen. You get through it.
And I know there's a lot of money involved, but still, it's a lot of work for one performance. Wow.
I know, but there, but the headline is there's a lot of money.
That's always a good thing.
Absolutely.
Martin Short is here on Saturday night with Steve Martin at Ovens Auditorium at 8 o'clock in an evening you will forget for the rest of your lives.
Or?
Yes.
See them before they're dead.
See them before they're dead. Martin Short, thank you so much for the time you've given us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. My pleasure.
You know, even the best of organizations can make the occasional misstep. And once in a while, those mistakes can become public relations nightmares. United Airlines went against their own slogan, "Fly the Friendly Skies," when they recently dragged a passenger off one of their planes to make way for an employee. Adidas, the running shoemaker with the best of intentions, recently congratulated participants in the Boston Marathon for surviving the race. And Facebook found itself again having to apologize for the behavior of one of its users when a cold-blooded murderer posted his crime on his Facebook page. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg has promised to take steps to see that this kind of tragedy never happens again. But is that a promise that can be kept in a world of social media? And if a PR blunder has been made, how can you fix it? We're going to talk about that with Dr. Stephen Cox and Anne-Marie Holder. Stephen Cox is professor of marketing at Queen's University of Charlotte's McCall School of Business. Anne-Marie Holder is a marketing and public relations professional and CEO of Spark Strategic Ideas. And they both join us now. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike.
We don't want to pick on any – well, we're going to have to. we don't want to pick on any particular company, but it was the United Airlines incident in which they dragged a passenger off that Louisville flight from Chicago to make way for needed seats for their crew that got us thinking, what happens when a company does something that the public views as horrific? So how would the two of you assess United's handling of that situation, Anne-Marie?
Well, it's definitely a complicated story with a lot of different layers. But there was a lot of mistakes that were made, a lot of challenges when it comes to how they immediately responded, how they dealt with their employees, as well as just the general sentiment, not getting ahead of it when it comes to the backlash on social media. And a lot of times that also means that more and more people start to jump on that bandwagon, whether the additional stories are true or whether they're just people continuing to seek attention. It's a tough thing to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Cox, United did not immediately apologize. At first, their CEO offered a kind of a non-apology for having to, quote, reaccommodate these customers. He was basically apologizing for their overbooking policy, not what happened to the passenger. But they did eventually issue a full apology at a big company with access to the best advice out there. Why didn't they cut this off with a full and immediate apology? I mean, isn't that the only choice that you really have in a situation like this?
The answer to the question is yes. It's the only thing you can do. You have to be upfront, transparent, and let the public know that, hey, we screwed up. However, you know, the media today, think back, you know, 5 years ago when we didn't have cell phones and we couldn't take pictures of things like that on airplanes, would this have been a big deal? Well, sort of, but, you know, it's not going to go on YouTube. It's not going to go anyplace else. And so it's not going to be as exciting.
A picture is worth a thousand words, and you see this guy being dragged down the aisle with a bloodied nose. I mean, that sticks in your head more than just people saying there was a passenger dragged off the airplane today.
Right, and so my point here is that companies need to improve the way they handle these nightmares.
But this is a big company, and the companies we're going to talk about in this episode, this segment, are all big companies, and they have, as I said, access to the best of the best in public relations and advice, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How can these mistakes still be happening?
Well, I think a lot of times the immediate reaction is to get the lawyers on the line, and they play an important role. You've got to protect the equity of the company itself. But there's also a genuineness that can be made that a company is genuinely sorry that this happened. There are ways that you can not necessarily admit fault, but express regret. And just speaking in generalities, not necessarily this particular situation, but you can very genuinely talk to your customers. Hmm. And I think that's a mistake many people make.
This incident followed a previous one 2 weeks earlier in which two 10-year-old girls were barred from wearing leggings on a flight. And one airline expert said that between the two of these things, flying has become increasingly unpleasant. And this is more than a PR crisis. This amounts to anti-branding. When we come back, we'll talk about that and what this does to your brand when things go wrong with our two guests, Dr. Stephen Cox and Anne-Marie Holder. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting singer-songwriter John Prine. 45 years of music in the vein of Dylan, Springsteen, and Bonnie Raitt. September 16th at Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Voting in France's high-stake election is just days away, and after last year's Brexit vote, the French election is seen as a referendum on Europe's future, as the two frontrunners are polar opposites when it comes to staying in the EU. They'll be talking about that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point here on WFAE. We will continue our conversation about what to do when everything goes wrong, how to get it right, if that's possible. Stay with us.
Martin Grable, President and CEO, Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, talks about underwriting on WFAE.
We get to support a community-based public radio station. reaching a diverse group of local listeners. And I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and say they've heard our message on WFAE.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. Learn more. Email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Anne-Marie Holder, CEO of Spark Strategic Ideas, and Dr. Stephen Cox, professor of marketing at Queen's University of Charlotte's McCall School of Business. One PR expert called this anti-branding, what happened to United Airlines, and there are several other instances that we'll be talking about over the course of this next few minutes that maybe could fall into that same category. And Anne-Marie, one of the things that you stress in these situations is to understand the brand. In United case, what does that mean? I mean, for as long as I can remember, their branding slogan has been "Fly the Friendly Skies."
Exactly. They went against the core of who they said they were. You know, at its core, your brand is a promise. And so when an incident like this occurs and it's not handled properly and you don't come out genuinely and think first of your customers and how to protect them, both physically as well as, you know, the image there, it's a problem.
But the whole practice that the entire airline industry uses of overbooking flights to make sure they maximize their profits seems to be flying in the face of Fly the Friendly Skies.
Absolutely. It is. But at some point, part of that is just business. It's the way they operate. It's part of the way they keep costs down. But it's more in how they handle this particular incident.
Yeah, but they don't overbook theaters. They don't overbook sports stadiums to maximize their profit. Why do they do it in the airlines? Why is that not seen as something? I mean, flying has become a miserable experience. It's the antithesis of what they said it was going to be on all those commercials they ran in the 1960s and 70s.
I would agree with that. It's not always an easy thing, but I think they're looking at profitability and more ways to get people to the skies. And so it at some point becomes a cost value analysis of, you know, where is that line? But do they have to overbook this much? What is the backup plan? And what are all the policies in place? And quite honestly, how do they make it worthwhile if they do need to bump somebody? At some point, somebody's going to be willing to give up a seat.
Pepsi, of course, found itself in a PR dilemma just prior to the United problem when they released an online ad that seemed to trivialize the Black Lives Matter movement in particular and protests and marches in general. It aired a couple, maybe once or twice, and the criticism went viral. How was it possible, Dr. Cox, that they missed the negatives that others saw instantly when it went on the air?
You know, that's really hard to say. One of the things that companies tend to do is they separate their advertising from their PR. And the advertising...
Well, they're not the same.
Well, they aren't the same, and... But the PR group is going to be more sensitive to what the downside effects of something can be than potentially the advertisers. Remember, the advertising group, they're either trying to inform, persuade, or remind.
Right.
Well, this ad, you know, reminded people of not the people who were upset about it, but if you look at it, it's how wonderful Pepsi is and how it brings people together and all those sorts of things. And so the theme, I thought, was a really good one. The problem was some of the background role that they used, you know, upset a lot of people, and they shouldn't have done that. And had the two groups worked together better, you might have been able to do the same type of ad but not use the same background role.
Well, in Pepsi's case, they pulled that ad very quickly. They took responsibility for it. Was that the right thing to do? Was that the best that they could do? Was there anything else they should have done, Dr. Cox?
That was textbook. I mean, they were absolutely textbook. They apologized. They took it right down. They took complete responsibility for it. They said that Jenner, who was the lead in it, that it wasn't her fault. She's not that kind of a person. I think they diffused it exceptionally well.
And then SNL, Saturday Night Live, did a spoof commercial of it. Should they be concerned about that, or really is all publicity good publicity?
Well, I wouldn't say all publicity is good publicity. But, you know, there's another thing, Mike, that we ought to consider here, and that is how long does bad publicity last? And think about Toyota. I mean, we've all heard the 2010 family that dies on a 911 call. Toyota denies and then, you know, that it's a problem. They even ended up with a $1.2 billion fine by the U.S. government. Toyota Camrys and Corollas are still the leading selling cars in the United States.
Somebody did, just as a sidebar here, somebody did a study on that and found out that there probably wasn't anything wrong with those cars. I can't get into it now, but so it's a good thing, I suppose, that things have recovered for them. Social media is speeding everything up in the world today. Things spread like wildfire. That's why we have this phrase that went viral, especially if things are bad news. It isn't only spreading faster, it's reaching more people more quickly. So how has that changed the way companies need to respond to public relations disasters, Anne-Marie?
Well, you certainly have to be more prepared from the get-go. You have to have a plan in place of what is going to happen, who is going to speak, are they the right spokesperson, and be prepared to manage that. Certainly, you've got to have people manning your various social media outlets and have a strategy for what comes next after that. But it is speeding up.
You stress that something will go wrong, so have a plan in place. Don't all big companies have plans for things like this, or can you have a plan? Can a blanket plan fit in certain situations?
It's not always necessarily one large plan. It might be if something happens with regard to safety, this is the person that's going to speak, this is how they'll handle it. So they're prepared and equipped. Or if something happens with a customer, it's this. Or something happens with our food, it's that. So you can have various plans. You can't plan for every single scenario, but you can absolutely have a least a number of steps that have to be taken, and you have to be prepared with when something goes wrong, because it will. How do we manage that?
In United's case, they put their CEO out front and center, and when I saw him on TV, he appeared to be genuinely apologetic and sincere in that apology and concerned about how the company acted. But not all CEOs are good on camera. They just aren't. That's not in their wheelhouse. That's not their strong suit. Is it okay if in the aftermath of these things we do not hear from the CEO for whom the buck stops? Is it okay that we hear from some other person? Is that all right?
I think it can be okay. You certainly want to make sure that you've got support from the top down, and it may be better for them to release a written statement versus them being the one that is actually on air being seen. Some people showcase their genuineness in a better way than others. So it can definitely be helpful to have that right spokesperson.
Steve Stevenson is the man who murdered an elderly black man on Easter Sunday in cold blood and did it, posted it on his Facebook page, which created a crisis of sorts, I suppose, for Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's founder, felt the need to reference it in a recent speech in which he said that Facebook, and this is a quote, I think, must do better, and they would try to prevent such tragedies in the future. Dr. Cox, this doesn't seem to me to be a Facebook problem, and I don't know how Facebook could prevent this tragedy.
Actually, it is a Facebook problem. It's a problem because of what they can't affect the tragedy, but they can affect what goes on Facebook.
But how?
They monitor, just as YouTube does and everyone else, what's going on.
But it's one thing to monitor. You can use algorithms to monitor text. Mm-hmm. How can you use algorithms to monitor a piece of video that went up 5 seconds ago?
You're going to have some period of time in which it stays up, but you can have a variety of different ways to take a look at that.
I mean, to me, that was the wrong thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. Because for Mark, I know he needed to say something, and he felt he needed to say something, but he said, we'll do better and try to prevent such tragedies in the future. To me, the only way you could prevent somebody taking advantage of the fact that they can now run a television station on Facebook is to take that capability away from all users. No more video.
Well, you know, that's YouTube is working very hard to bring down a lot of the things that are concerning to people. Mm. And, you know, one of the backlashes they run into is the fact that, you know, sometimes their algorithms take down stuff that people would want on there. For instance, if they're worried about battered women and they have a charitable organization that's working for battered women, the term might take their stuff down. So it's a difficult thing to do.
Fox News yesterday found it necessary to part company with their longtime primetime star Bill O'Reilly because of allegations of sexual harassment on Mr. O'Reilly's part. These allegations, they've been floating around for a long time. Roger Ailes, the former Fox News chairman, was let go earlier due to similar allegations. Is this for Fox, either Fox News itself or the 21st Century Fox parent company, which also owns FX and the Fox TV network and the movie studio? Is this a Does this qualify as a public relations problem or nightmare for them? I'm not sure which one of you to ask. Anne, I'll ask you, Anne-Marie.
Sure. It is. Certainly any time that your brand is impacted, it can be considered a crisis. You want to make sure that you're protecting it and have the steps in place. There are going to be people who are very much for the brand and very much against it. And part of the reason that Bill has been successful is because he's so polarizing, and that's embraced. And
well, so he's denied the charges, so he could be innocent. I mean, there is the possibility that Bill O'Reilly's not guilty of these charges. Does that provide a nightmare? Because he has tons of fans.
It's true. I think it's a big challenge, and they very gently released him. I mean, if you take a look at this statement that they have decided to part company along with Bill O'Reilly. It was not a harsh firing. It was a mutual decision.
Mm-hmm. That's the best way to handle this. But they've also admitted to paying $13 million, the network and Bill O'Reilly, to people who have accused him. And he says that's because it's just easier to stop the conversation that way and to protect his children from this conversation by making these payments. And in a way, a lot of people are subject to that kind of blackmail, are they not? How does that play into all of this? Who do we believe?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. In terms of sometimes it is sort of better to try to sweep something under the rug. But what happens when you do that is eventually it comes out. And, you know, in this $13 million, you know, the average person on the street is going, no, that's too much to be – you know, it wasn't a big deal. Mm. And so as a result, you've exacerbated the problem by trying to sweep the problem under the rug. Mm. And they needed to be, as both Anne-Marie and I have said, be much more transparent and a long time ago.
And at some point, the rug can only hold so much.
Yeah, that's true.
You start noticing the little piles of dust under the rug.
Right.
PR expert Rich Donnelly, who's the senior vice president of a Detroit-based PR firm called MCCI, says that it can take years to build a brand, but only 1 second to lose it. And this is amplified by citizen journalists with phones in hand, capturing every moment and posting instantly on social media. Have any of the most recent incidents or responses to those incidents been examples of brand killing? Have we gotten that far in any of these recent incidences? Or ever? I can't remember a time when a brand has been killed by anything.
You know, quite frankly, I think that the lifespan of bad PR is not as long as we like to think that it is. And again, I'll go back to the Toyota example. You know, the lifespan of that was not very long. And so, you know, as you look at that, you go, you know, what's the news tomorrow?
Yeah. That was going to be my next question. Is social media and the ability to capture these things and spread them virally and quickly and deeply throughout the population on a regular basis simply numbing us to what 10 years ago would have been appalling?
I think it does to some extent, but it's also a matter of how it is managed from a public relations standpoint. So it can be that social media moves us so quickly that the next story comes over, washes over everybody in a wave, and then we're on to the next story. Or it can be something that really has an impact on a brand and it snowballs and just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it's how you manage that process that's really going to have an impact on the long-term brand equity.
Following the Boston Marathon, Adidas, the athletic shoe company, sent an email to finishers congratulating them on surviving the marathon. In a statement, Adidas called the race one of the most inspirational sporting events in the world. Clearly, they said there was no thought given to the insensitive email subject line that was sent yesterday. We deeply apologize for our mistake. Was that the best way to handle this, Doctor?
From my perspective, it was the only way to handle it. You know, a lot of times things are done. I mean, you asked the question earlier on CEOs. You know, the CEO of BP said, "I want to get my life back." Well, he said that, you know, I'm sure that wasn't in his script. And, you know, all of a sudden that goes viral because 11 people lose their lives. A lot of people, you know, we know what happened on that oil rig. And so, you know, it's a difficult thing, you just have to say.
But there's a difference in an off-the-cuff remark like he made, the CEO of BP, and an email that goes out. Given the layers of things that you have to go through in corporate America to get approval on anything, how does an email congratulating survivors of the Boston Marathon get through? How does that happen?
I think it actually happens pretty easily. There's so many pieces of communication that are going out. That's all it's not going up to the CEO to approve. But I think in today's world, we judge ourselves by our intentions and other people by their actions. And so, if you can come out and honestly apologize and move on, that's your best scenario.
So the shorthand here is have a plan, apologize quickly, fix the problem, and be truthful.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Dr. Stephen Cox, professor of marketing at Queen's University of Charlotte and McCall School of Business. Anne Marie Holder is CEO of Spark Strategic Ideas. Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.